Okay, we need to finish up the unit today because test two is in under 2 days. Just under 2 days. I don't really exactly remember where we were. Did we get to this yet?
Yes.
Have we talked about it already? Okay. So let's go on to 9 then, which will finish up vision. This is a view of the retina from inside the eyeball. So we're looking at the back of the retina. And I've already described the blind spot to you. That's the blind spot is at what we call structurally the optic disc. When you did your dissection, you might have noticed that the retina was that whitish film that might have hung on in one place on the eyeball. It was still attached. That one place is the optic disc. Why is that the blind spot? Right, there aren't any rods and cones, and why is that true? Why aren't there any rods and cones there?
Because that's where all the nerves go out.
Yeah, there just isn't any room for rods and cones because all the axons that are coming from those ganglionic cells have to exit the eyeball in one place, so they all come together there. There's just no room for rods and cones. And we've already talked about that. By the way, the vessels that you see here, you're really seeing through the retina to see those vessels. The vessels are not part of the retina. The vessels are part of what?
The
what?
The vitreous humor.
No. The vitreous humor is transparent jelly.
Intermediate.
Are you guys? No, you won't be able to use your notes on the test, right? You do not wait until the last night to prepare for a test. It's part of the choroid layer. The choroid layer is intermediate between the sclera and the retina, and that's where the vessels are. So you're really seeing through it. The retina itself is the light-sensitive area. And the only thing about this I haven't mentioned so far is this other spot, not the optic disc where the blind spot is, but this one that's called the macula, which is a word that really means spot. You don't really see it here, but the macula is kind of like a two-zone archery target. Smaller circle within a bigger circle. Now, there are rods and cones distributed all over the surface of the retina, which is why you see a whole scene whenever you look at somewhere. But in the macula, in the outer zone of the macula, you have an especially high concentration of rods. And then in the middle of the macula, which is the fovea centralis, you have an especially high concentration of cones. In other words, by concentration, I'm talking about cones are really packed together tightly with very little space between them compared to the rest of the retina. And so when you think about how you use your eyes to get the best look at something, you want to look straight at it, right? And you see the whole view, and you can tell there's a room here, but you don't really see the detail peripherally. You just tell that it's there. If you really want to get the details, you're going to have to change your gaze and point your eyes right at what you want to see the detail of. And that's because that light that's falling off to the sides is hitting areas of the retina that have much lower concentration or density of rods and cones. So you don't have as much resolution. It's just like bigger pixels on a computer screen, right? Or when you see American TV pixelate nudity so that you don't see the nudity, like it's going to harm you. When we point our eyes straight at something, we're forcing that light to strike specifically at the macula, and even more particularly in the fovea centralis of the macula, which will give you, assuming you have enough light, which is more light is required for cones, That's going to give you very good resolution and color information. But remember what I said about rods. They don't give you color information, but they are easier to fire because they don't require as much light energy.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether you've ever experienced this, but you could try it. If you look up at stars at night, starry sky, you might have to get out of the city to see stars well enough. But if you look directly at a star, you'll see it, of course, but it won't actually be as sharp as it can be. Because if you look directly at it, you're forcing that light to go onto the fovea, right? Which I just told you is full of cones, and starlight doesn't have all that much light. So if you instead look just a little bit to the side of the star, then it'll actually become more sharp for you. And that's because you're forcing that light to fall still in the macula, but in this zone around the fovea where there's a hell of a lot of rods which don't require as much light. So you can try that. It does work. Now let's go on to audition. Actually, audition and balance. Remember that the ear is a dual special sense organ. It allows for the special sense of audition or hearing and for the special sense of balance. When we talk about ears in everyday language, we're not really talking about the deep part, but you see the entire ear here. Usually what we are cosmetically interested in are just the visible part of the ear, the outer flap, which is the pinna or auricle. It's shaped basically like a funnel for good reason. It acts as a funnel. It makes it much more easy to collect sound waves and direct them into the tunnel, which is called the external acoustic meatus. Older books would call it the auditory canal. They both really mean the same thing. It's the ear hole to you, but it's a tunnel that ends at a membrane barrier called what you probably call the eardrum. The proper name for the eardrum is the tympanic membrane. Tympanic means drum, right? The tympani are the drums, the kettle drums of the orchestra. So tympanic means drum-like. That's the official end. The tympanic membrane is the boundary between what we call the outer ear or external ear, the pinna and the acoustic meatus, and the middle ear, which you don't see, and you shouldn't try to feel either, because you'd have to break your eardrum to do that. But the middle ear is a air-filled chamber that has some bones in it that are important. The boundary between those two, though, is the tympanic membrane itself. All right. Now, there are three bones in each ear, so six overall, that are by far the smallest bones in the body. They're tiny. They're about this big. Much smaller than... they're about the size of... They're small. They're called auditory ossicles. Ossicle simply means small bone. And so you might have heard of these before by their common name, hammer, anvil, and stirrup. There are other words that mean those things that are more anatomical terms, malleus, incus, and stapes. And that's the order in which they occur from lateral to medial. So the malleus, or hammer, is connected on one of its ends to the medial surface of the tympanic membrane, the eardrum. On the other side of the eardrum, the part that you can't get to. And then the other end of the malleus is connected to one end of the incus, or anvil. And then the other end of that incus or anvil is connected to the stapes or stirrup. Now these are named for their resemblance to these objects. hammer is roughly shaped like the hammer, or the malleus is roughly hammer-like. The incus, kind of like a blacksmith's anvil. But the one that is really well-named is the stapes, or stirrup, because if you look at a real stirrup, tiny bone, it is really shaped just like a stirrup that you put your foot in if you ride a horse. And the flat part of that stirrup, which is where the sole of your boot would go, that is connected directly to a membrane on this big organ right here, and specifically a part of that organ called the vestibule. And that membrane that the foot of the stapes is connected to is called the oval window. Now this big internal structure that has several parts to it is the part of the ear that houses the sense organ, the sensory receptors, I should say. The part of it looks very much like a snail, which is why it's called cochlea, which means snail. It's what makes it look like a snail's shell is that it really is a tube that's wrapped up. All right, so this is the cochlea. Then this part in the middle is the vestibule. That's where the oval window is, where the foot of the stapes meets. And then you have three semicircular canals. And the semicircular canals are mutually orthogonal. What does that mean? It just means that they are at right angles to each other. Just like the three planes of dissection are at right angles to each other, so are these three semicircular canals. That's why they are at right angles to each other, because there are three dimensions. And so the swirling of liquid that's inside those semicircular canals, the way in which that swirling is happening, tells the brain which direction particularly your head is moving in. Because any given direction is going to be some combination of X, Y, and Z. That's why they're placed that way. So this cochlea, vestibule, and semicircular canals conglomeration of structures is really both organs for both senses. The vestibule and the semicircular canals house the receptors that are important for balance, the sense of balance, which is one of the special senses, remember. And the cochlea houses the sensory receptors that are responsible for sending information to the brain about that will result in the sensation of audition or hearing. Okay, now back to these auditory ossicles. Why do we have them? They are there as an amplification device. The sensory receptors in the cochlea, actually in all parts of this, for balance and for audition, but here we're talking about audition, they are examples of mechanoreceptors. What does that mean? How do mechanoreceptors work? Well, where else did we encounter mechanoreceptors that we've already talked about? Almost all of the sensory receptors we talked about were mechanoreceptors. The only ones that weren't were the photoreceptors in the eye. Mechanoreceptors are receptors that fire or create an action potential when they are deformed, mechanically deformed, whether they're squeezed or bent or stretched. So all the ones that we talked about in the skin, right? All those dermal sensory receptors, those were mechanoreceptors. You push on them or squeeze them, whatever. And that causes neurons to fire.
So the reason there's the three occipital bones, because sort of like when the sound comes in your ear, and if it travels through air, it won't be as like audible to our ears. That's why it goes through the bones. So, like, the sound goes through the bone.
Well, in a way, yeah. I'm still getting to that.
Okay.
But, and that's why I'm mentioning the mechanoreceptors, because mechanoreceptors will not send any information to the brain unless you push on them hard enough, basically. All right, unless you deform them enough. And they are in the interior of this cochlea, which is filled with liquid. Liquid is much denser than air, right? And therefore much harder to push on. Now, when we hear something, that occurs in the brain, as I've said, but that doesn't happen unless you have some sort of disturbance out in the environment creating sound pressure waves in the air, right? So, you know, just it's amazing how sensitive the ears are. I mean, you just do this, just barely touching this. That's causing molecules of air to push on the next molecules of air, which then push on the next molecules of air. Trillions and trillions of molecules later at your ear, it's now pushing on your tympanic membrane or eardrum. And you can imagine that's not going to make it move very much, right? But that's pushing on air, which is a lot easier to do than push on liquid. And that somehow has to cause a wave of pressure inside a liquid compartment in the cochlea for it to actually be able to move these mechanoreceptors, deform them enough to send information to the brain. And so whatever that disturbance is that causes what we eventually sense as the noise, that you're stuck with that amount of force, right? The event, whatever it is, determines the force of that. You can't increase the force, but you can increase the pressure. And that's what the auditory ossicles are all about. So it's important to understand the difference between force and pressure. What is the difference? What is pressure?
The measure of how condensed something could
do. What do you mean by condensed? Well, force is involved in pressure. Pressure is simply force per area, or force divided by area, which is why you have units like pounds per square inch. Pounds is a unit of force. Square inches is a unit of area, so pounds per square inch is pressure. Okay? Well, the tympanic membrane, or the eardrum, is receiving this force from the molecules hitting it, right? So there's a certain amount of force, but there's also a certain constant amount of surface area that the tympanic membrane has. So whatever the force is divided by that area is the pressure. Just to use another example, weight is an example of force. It's the force due to gravity. So I'm exerting a force on the floor called my weight. All right? That force, my weight, divided by the combined surface area of my two footprints is the pressure of me onto the floor, which is different from my force. You see the difference? And if you don't see the difference, just notice what happens when I lift one leg. I still have the same weight. So I'm exerting the same force, but now it's being distributed over one half of that area. You're dividing by a smaller number. What happens to the quotient or the answer when you divide by a smaller number? It gets bigger. So I've doubled the pressure by halving or cutting in half the area. And to make it a more extreme example, if I stood with one foot on the point of a needle, which I'm not going to do for you, that point of the needle has a tiny, tiny area, right? Still the same force, though. My whole weight divided by that tiny area is going to be an enormous pressure, so great that it goes through my skin. That's exactly why sharp things are sharp, because they have very high pressure since they have very little area. And so we can't do anything about the force. That's determined by the event. You know, how hard I hit this is going to determine the force. But I can increase the pressure. That's what the auditory ossicles do. So you have a pressure defined by the area of the tympanic membrane. It then pushes on the malleus, which pushes on the incus, which pushes on the stapes, which pushes on the oval window. But the oval window has a surface area that is about 1/20th the area of the eardrum. So in other words, that same amount of force, you lose a little bit of force to friction, of course. But roughly the same amount of force now applied over 1/20th the area means that you've increased the pressure 20 times. And so now that pressure is great enough for it to push on the liquid that's on the inside of that vestibule, just on the other side of the oval window. And then that pressure wave that's created in the liquid is what is going to eventually deform some mechanoreceptors inside the cochlea, allowing action potentials to be created and sent to the brain, which then creates the sensation of hearing for you. All right? Does that answer what you were asking before?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you don't really get a good view of it in this picture, because this is a cutaway view, but this whole sensitive structure, the cochlea, the vestibule, and the three semicircular canals, are entirely encased, completely encased in bone. So there's no space around them. All of the membrane that makes up that surface is right up against bone. And the reason that's important is because if it were not against bone, and you see it right here, it's against bone, but the whole thing is, if it were not against bone and you pushed on it, it would just balloon out somewhere, right? You don't want that to happen because you want that to push on the mechanoreceptors rather than just bulging out the wall. So it's completely encased in bone. Also notice that you have this yellow nerve connected to it. This is one of the 12 cranial nerves that we talked briefly about. It's called the vestibulocochlear nerve. It really has two parts, the vestibular tributary and the cochlear tributary. And I say tributary rather than branch because this is sensory. It's going, the information is flowing this way, right? And just like a river doesn't have branches, it has tributaries. They converge rather than diverge. But anyway, there's a vestibular part of the vestibulocochlear nerve that is responsible for carrying information for balance from the vestibule and semicircular canals. And the cochlear part of that same nerve connects to the cochlea and sends information to the brain about audition or hearing. Keep in mind, by the way, that all the information that the brain is receiving, whether it's from the ear or anything else, is all exactly the same. It's all just action potentials. But you have completely different sensations, right? Depending on where that information is coming from. So the brain has to keep track, since all it's getting is action potentials, it has to keep track of where that particular action potential is coming from in the body. Because if it's coming from the cochlea, then it creates the sensation of hearing for you. If it's coming from the vestibule, then it's going to be for balance. If it's coming from the eye, it's going to cause vision. But they're all the same signals. Okay. If we take a closer view of this sensitive structure, the cochlea and the vestibule and semicircular canals, in slide 11, with all the bone removed, you just see a better view of the fact that the semicircular canals correspond to the X, Y, and Z planes. They're all at right angles to each other. But they're also hollow, and you can see a little detail right here at where they connect to the vestibule. Each semicircular canal has a kind of cone-shaped cupula, as it's called, which is how these things operate. But there's a better view in the next slide. Well, actually, in slide 13, but let's talk about 12 first. There are two categories of balance. It's all one special sense. But we can subdivide balance into static balance and dynamic balance. Static and dynamic are opposites of each other. They're used for to describe a lot of things. But what's the difference? What does static mean? Yes, it means unchanging, whereas dynamic means changing. And so by static balance, the reason it's called static is because you're staying in the same position. You have changed positions, so it changes for a second, but then you keep your head in a new position, like this woman who's going from the anatomical position to pointing her head downward. When that happens, in the vestibule, which is the part of the whole structure that's responsible for static balance, there is basically a slab of gel-like material that will be able to slide. So if you tilt the head, it's going to start sliding downhill. And when that gel starts sliding, it brushes against these hair cells, which are the mechanoreceptors. And when those hair cells get bent or deformed by the gel, then that's going to cause ions to flow, which creates action potentials, right? Just like we've talked about before. This is just a little bit different setup. And those action potentials get created in neurons that send their axons to the brain via the vestibulocochlear nerve. But specifically the vestibular part of that vestibulocochlear nerves, because this is information about balance. And so the brain receives that and says, oh, you must have tilted your head because this gel is sliding. I'm getting information about this gel sliding. So it does what's appropriate for you to maintain balance. In other words, it fires the right muscles for you to stay in balance. That is static balance, which is the vestibule's job. The three semicircular canals, on the other hand, shown in 13, well, we're looking at just one of them, they are responsible for dynamic balance, which is balance while you are moving. And I've already explained that's why they are at right angles, because any given movement is going to be some combination of X, Y, and Z. So if you are moving your head in the no position, in the no gesture, shaking it back and forth, you're going to cause a lot more swirling in the horizontally placed semicircular canals than in either of the ones that are vertically placed, right? And so the brain will interpret that as, oh, you must be moving it in this direction. Whereas if you're doing this, it's going to cause much more swirling in the vertical one than the horizontal one, and so on. But there's going to be a flow in all three. It's just going to be some ratio of level of flow for the three. And the brain interprets that and figures out what to do about it. You can see this cupola that I described when you could barely see it in the two slides ago. It's close-up view now. And so it's basically just a mass that is connected to hair cells, but that mass gets moved when in one direction or the other when the liquid inside the semicircular canals moves past the cupola. So that's what causes the deformation, and that's what creates the action potentials. Now, this is also how humans, and particularly kids, seem to do this more than humans. Humans usually just drink to get the feeling, but kids spin around to get dizzy. And doing that really just confuses the hell out of your brain. Because if you're spinning around, the semicircular canals on this side of your head are telling the brain, this is down, even though it's not down. It thinks it's down, right? Because that's the way the force is, centrifugally. Meanwhile, this one says, no, this is down. And the brain doesn't know what to do. The brain is trying to send signals to skeletal muscles to contract the correct muscles to keep you up. But when it's getting conflicting signals, it fires muscles or relaxes muscles that should be fired, and you fall over. Usually, though, in just a normal movement, it figures things out well, and you don't fall over. All right, so that's balance. Let's go back to audition now, slide 14. Now, I told you that the cochlea, which is the organ of audition, is a coiled-up tube. But the tube is not the same diameter along its length. It starts out wide and then gets narrow, like that. If you imagine that to be a tube. So it's kind of a cone-shaped tube. But then when you roll that up, you get the cochlea shape. It's easier to figure out how it works, though, if you imagine it unrolled first. And anyway, what we're looking at in slide 14 is just a slice of it cut somewhere along its length. Okay, so we're looking at a cross-section of this conical tube called the cochlea. And notice within that tube there are actually three chambers. You have the vestibular, the scala vestibuli, which could be called the vestibular chamber, but scala vestibuli means the same thing. The scala tympani, and then between those two is a chamber that houses all of the mechanoreceptors. The sensitive cells that create action potentials to be sent to the brain. And all of that stuff in the middle collectively is called the organ of Corti, named after an Italian. Now, you don't get a very good view here. We'll take a closer up view in a different slide. But notice that the mechanoreceptors are right here. They're sitting on a membrane as the floor. And that membrane, it's not labeled here, but it's called the basilar membrane. That floor that it's sitting on, though, is not a hard floor. It's like a membrane itself. So it can move up and down. And then above the mechanoreceptors is a little roof. It's also a membrane, but it's much stiffer. And it's not labeled here, but we'll see that it's called the tectorial membrane. That's a word that means roof, actually. It's a good name because the way that these action potentials get created, the way the deformation works that's necessary for the mechanoreceptors to fire, is that they get jammed up, the hair cells, as they're called, get jammed up into the roof, the tectorial membrane. Only if they move enough, though. Okay? So that's what's going to happen. Let's take a much closer look in slide 15. So this is just the organ of Corti. We're much closer up now. This is just that middle chamber, which could also be called the cochlear chamber. Anyway, this is the basilar membrane. That's what the hair cells are sitting on. But that is a very pliable floor. Kind of like a wrestling floor, right? Or a boxing floor. It's not a hard floor. It can go up and down. This tectorial membrane, on the other hand, stays pretty much put. It's much more rigid. And these are called hair cells because they have these little stereocilia or hair-like structures on the end. That if those get jammed up into the bottom of the tectorial membrane, then that's going to cause channels to open and action potentials to be created to be sent to the brain. Okay? If it doesn't happen, if the basilar membrane does not move enough to jam those hair cells up into the tectorial membrane, then no action potential will be created. Okay? Which is what's happening during silence. When you're not hearing anything, they're just staying put. So, actually, let me stay on this. So what's happening is that whatever the disturbance in the environment is causes a pressure wave in the air, right? That pushes on the tympanic membrane, and then that pressure gets amplified by the auditory ossicles roughly 20 times, so that it's enough to push on the fluid, well, it pushes on the oval window, which pushes on the fluid on the other side of that oval window, which is inside this cochlea. And that sets up a pressure wave in the liquid inside this entire cochlea. All right? This is why it's important for this to be entirely encased in bone, because like I was saying earlier, if it weren't, it would just bulge out the side, and that wouldn't move any of these hair cells. Since it's a hard wall because of the bone, that means the deformation has to be, it has to squeeze on this basilar membrane when the pressure gets there. And if it does, with great enough force, it will jam them up into the tectorial membrane. So that explains how you're either getting information or not sending information to the brain, right? Depending on whether it pushes these hair cells. But you know that it's not just, there's a lot of information that's part of hearing. You can also, you can't, it's, you can tell much more than just whether or not there's a sound, right? You can tell differences in pitch, for instance, for differences in frequency, which is what the next slide is all about, slide 16. Anything that is wave-like has frequency. Frequency is related to wavelength. Long wavelengths have low frequency. The frequency is how many wavelengths pass a given point in a given amount of time. So they're more frequent or have a higher frequency if the wavelength is shorter, like this. Okay? Now we interpret or sense higher frequency as high pitch. Frequency is pitch, basically, in terms of sound. And so we can tell whether it's a low note or a high note, for instance. So how does that work is the question. Well, this is where it's important that the cochlea is not just a tube, but a tube that tapers. So this is the entire cochlea, unwrapped, as I've said. But within that, you have the basilar membrane, right, which has basically the same shape. It's just the middle part of that overall cross-section. So the tube is round, but the basilar membrane is a flat, tapering membrane inside that. You see what I'm saying? And here we have to understand what's called resonance and resonant frequency. Every object has a particular resonant frequency, which is simply the frequency at which it wants to vibrate or oscillate. You know, for instance, just as you see here, if you pluck a string of a stringed instrument, whether it's guitar, a cello, a viola, whatever, you pluck it and let go, it's going to vibrate at a specific frequency that it wants to vibrate at. That's its resonant frequency. And another example would be a swing, for instance, right? If you push a swing, which is a pendulum, really, it goes back and forth with a certain frequency. And if you have a longer chain, for instance, it will have a different frequency than a shorter chain. Okay? But every object has a resonant frequency. That's its natural frequency, in a sense. Now, using the swing analogy, if you're helping a kid swing by pushing him or her, you obviously do it by watching what you're doing, right? And you push only when the kid's back here. But if you got up there and closed your eyes and said, I'm just going to push at this frequency, and you just steadily do that, and it's not the actual resonant frequency of the swing, then sometimes he's going to be up here and you're going to be pushing air, doing nothing, right? And other times you might even be stopping him more because he comes back and you push. So that's not going to help that swinging out. But if you happen to actually be doing this at the resonant frequency for that system, which would be that particular swing, then you would be pushing at exactly the right time every time. And that would make it really drastically move. Okay? And similarly with strings, right? If you push on strings with air from a tuning fork, it will cause that string with just that same frequency to really vibrate. So this is what's happening at the basilar membrane of the cochlea. The pressure wave gets set up by the stapes because, you know, whatever the disturbance is has a certain frequency. That pushes with the same frequency on the tympanic membrane. The auditory ossicles then push, specifically the stapes pushes with that same frequency on the oval window, and therefore creates a pressure wave with that particular frequency in the liquid of the cochlea. And that pressure wave is pushing on all parts of the basilar membrane. But since it varies in its width along the length, there is only one part along its length that actually wants to vibrate at that frequency. And so that would be like finding the right length swing to push on at that frequency, and it's really going to move it a lot. And that's what causes just that part of the tympanic, of the basilar membrane, to move so much that it jams the hair cells up into the tectorial membrane and sends information to the brain. The rest of it won't move enough. And so the brain says, okay, I'm getting action potentials from the cochlear nerve, so I'm going to make this a sound, first of all. But specifically, I'm getting these action potentials from this region of the basilar membrane, so I'm going to make the sound seem like this frequency to you. If it moves a wider part, which will have a lower resonant frequency, it's going to create a lower note sensation for you. The higher notes are up here. And even though this is all one membrane, you can kind of think of it as a hell of a lot of strings of a harp right next to each other of different length. But it's not really strings, it's all one membrane. In fact, I've never seen one, but you could build a drum with a triangular drum skin, right? And if you play it at different places, it's going to have different frequencies. So that's what's happening. We see that in slide 17. This is kind of the harp thing I was just drawing. Different widths continuously along the length of the basilar membrane mean that only one part of the basilar membrane is really going to resonate at the frequency that's being received at the eardrum. And that's represented here by this part that's bulging. The rest of it isn't moving nearly as much, but this part is bulging so much that those hair cells will be jammed up into the tectorial membrane. Now, it's not really shaped like this. The cochlea is actually rolled up to be more compact, but it still works the same way. Okay, that's audition. 18 is about olfaction, or sense of smell, which obviously the nose is involved in, but really it's... Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I have a question about audition.
Yeah.
And frequency.
Mm-hmm.
I know certain frequencies can't be heard, but do you get... Is that due to wear and tear in the ear?
Yeah, it's death of nerves. That's a good question. Yeah, when you're... Until you hit about 20, humans have a range of roughly 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. Hertz is one cycle per second. So the lowest notes we can hear is something that's happening 20 times a second. But the really highest pitches that a young person can hear is 20,000 times per second, which is a hell of a lot. Above that, humans just can't hear. Below 20, they can feel, but they can't hear it. Anyway, when you hit 20, you're already, in terms of your ears, getting old, and you gradually lose nerves that correspond to the narrowest part of the basilar membrane, which are the highest frequencies. And so you eventually don't hear as much high pitch, which is why people of different ages might be irritated by music that is the same that someone else is hearing at a different age. How it's mixed is different in their heads because they have different neural capacities. Now, the nose is obviously an organ for olfaction, but it's more than that. Its nose is also important for ventilation or breathing. And really, in terms of olfaction, it's not all that much of the nose is used for housing the receptors. It's the entire inner moist lining of the nose is called the nasal epithelium. But there's a particular region of the nasal epithelium that we're looking at in close up on the right here that houses the actual receptors. And these are not mechanoreceptors like the ear was or the ones in the skin are. These are chemoreceptors because they respond to the presence of specific chemicals. Now, sensation-wise, eventually, once the information hits the brain and gets integrated, remember, sensation isn't just the sensory input. It's the high-level processing of that sensory input after it reaches the brain that actually creates the sensation. The sensation of smell, though, or olfaction, only occurs for certain things. We can't smell, we can't create a sensation of smell for everything in the world. There are some things that we say don't have a smell. We say, just like we say that things are a color, I was talking about this last time, it's not really that the object has a color, the color's in your brain. Similarly, the things don't have a smell. It's just that certain chemicals interact with your nervous system in such a way that you have a sensation of smell and other things don't. Things that we can't smell at all, other things could perfectly well smell if they have the right kind of receptors. But chemoreceptors are specific for a certain kind of chemical. And so, obviously, since we have many different things that we can smell, we must have multiple different chemoreceptors housed in our nasal epithelium, and we do. Not all that many, though, because the best smelling humans, the humans that are best at smelling, people who are in charge of like rating perfumes and stuff before they come to the market, have like 4,000 or more different individual odors that they can discern or tell the difference between. But that's not to say that there are thousands of different kinds of olfactory receptors. There's roughly 50 kinds. But 50 is enough that when you use them in different combinations, because when you sniff, that's going to cause some of those 50 to fire, and which ones it does and in how much is firing for each of those categories, there's a lot of different combinations. That's why it can add up to thousands of different individual odor sensations. But it has to be the right kind of stuff. There are plenty of molecules that just will not cause them to fire at all. And those are the things that we say don't have any smell. It's just we can't smell them. But anyway, anything that does cause these chemoreceptors in the nose to create action potentials, we classify as odorants. Odorants are simply the things that we can smell. And this also involves hair-like structures. These are hair cells as well. Of course, it's not true hair. They just look like little hairs. But by having these hairy, in all of these cases, not just this, every time I've been talking about these hair cells, that really is just a way of looping the membrane back and forth many times to create a lot of surface area so that you can house a bunch of proteins in there, which are the channels that need to be opened. So the more channels you can have in there, the more flow of ions you can have, and the more sensitive the neuron can be or the receptor can be. Anyway, if it's the right kind of, if it's an odorant that particular kind of hair cell is able to bind to, that's what happens. And when an odorant binds to one of these proteins, the protein is doing basically the same thing that the acetylcholine receptors did in the synapse, right? The acetylcholine receptors, remember, were proteins that had that functioned not only as receptors, in that case receptors for acetylcholine, but also served as ion channels. So that's what odorants are in this case. They're acting like a signal. They are ligands. They're another example of a ligand binding to a protein. And when a ligand, whatever it is, binds to a protein, whatever it is, that protein changes shape, right? So the odorants bind to the receptors in the hair cells, and that causes the receptors to open up their channels, and ions flow through, and then you have an action potential created, and that gets sent to the brain. All right, so that's basically what happens. Now, these hair endings of these hair cells need to be inaccessible to the air that's coming into your nose. So they can't be inside the cranium, because the air can't get to there, right? They therefore have to, but that's where the brain is in the cranium, and that's where the nerves that connect to the brain are. So there needs to be a passageway through the bony wall of the cranium for these nerve endings to get to the nasal cavity. And even though when we did the skeletal system, you weren't required to know all of the cranial bones, you know some of them. One of them is called the ethmoid bone. It's one you didn't have to know. That's this bone right here. And that word ethmoid means sieve-like or full of holes. It has a horizontal part to it that's called the cribriform plate, which is another word that means the same thing ethmoid does, full of holes. And the reason it's full of holes is because those holes are passageways for these hair cells to send their axons through the bony holes to the main part of the olfactory nerves that get sent to the brain. The olfactory nerves, just like the optic nerves and the vestibulocochlear nerves, are cranial nerves sending information to your brain. Okay, so it figures out what combinations of these 50 kinds of olfactory receptors are firing, and it creates a sensation of smell based on what that is. Very similar sense in 19 is gustation, which, remember, is the other word for taste. They're very similar in how they work because they both use chemoreceptors. So it's really just happening in two different places in the body. You have certain things that act as that are chemicals that activate chemoreceptors in the nose. That's what we just talked about. Certain other chemicals can bind to receptors in the mouth, mainly the tongue, but also the cheeks, and that causes those chemoreceptors to fire as well. And just like we called things that are able to bind to the olfactory receptors odorants, because they cause sensation of odors, we call things that are able to bind to the chemoreceptors in the tongue tastants. Tastants are the things that we can taste. Go ahead.
When people say, if you're going to eat something gross, you cover your nose so you don't smell it, and they say that makes you taste it less. Is that
I was just about to mention this. Oh. People say this all the time, or something like, taste is some percentage smell.
Yeah.
Taste and smell are separate senses, but you're usually experiencing them both together. So what you really usually call the taste is partly taste and partly smell. And if you eliminate the smell part of that by covering your nose, or if you have a cold, then you're only getting the information from the mouth, and that creates only part of the overall sensation, and it seems like it doesn't taste as much. Well, it tastes just as much, you're just not experiencing the smell with it. But yeah, that's another way they're related. They're related in the experience, but they happen the same way too, via chemoreceptors. And most of those chemoreceptors are concentrated in the tongue, but they're spread out in the cheeks as well. You just don't taste nearly as well with your cheeks because they're kind of sparse. The tongue itself is full of bumps, and there are different size and shape bumps if you really look at your tongue carefully, but you've seen your bumps on your tongue. They are called papillae. That's a plural. Papilla is just one, but It's a real general word. We have papillae in several places in the body. You see that word quite a bit, but it just means a finger-like projection, kind of longish bump. Well, don't bother memorizing the different shapes of papillae that are shown here. Just know that they're papillae. Those are not taste buds, though. I'm sure you've heard of taste buds, but taste buds are much smaller than papillae. Taste buds are housed in the papillae. And you probably learned another thing you were lied about, not only the senses that we talked about earlier, but you were probably taught that there are four basic tastes. Have you learned this?
Like sour,
sweet. Salty, sweet, and bitter is probably what you were taught. That actually was an innocent lie, because that's what we believed for a long time. And then, not all that long ago, we discovered a fifth sense. Anyone know what I'm talking about? What the fifth sense is? The fifth taste, I'm sorry.
So is that sour, bitter?
We have sour or acid, bitter, sweet, and salty. And number five is umami. One of my first words as a kid. Umami is a Japanese word that means roughly deliciousness, but it specifically is talking about savory taste, which you get in meat and mushrooms and things like that. And so it's its own taste, because it has its own kind of receptors, just as the other four do. We just didn't know about it until 10 years ago or so. By the way, the umami receptors specifically respond to glutamate. And this is exactly why monosodium glutamate, MSG, if it's added to food as a seasoning, gives you that savory taste, even if it's not really all that savory to begin with. Okay, but it works the same way and as olfaction. Chemicals bind to receptors, and that opens up channels. You have different kinds of papillae, but don't think that one papilla will house only one kind of taste bud. That's not true. They just have different shapes for different reasons other than taste. Any kind of papilla can house any kind of taste buds. And the reason that you might have learned also not only about those different tastes, but you have different regions of the tongue that you taste those at best. Well, you can taste all of the five tastes on any part of the tongue, but there are specific regions where you'll really get a strong taste if that's where you put the tastants. The salty region of the tongue has a higher percentage of salt receptors than the other kinds, and so on. Yeah.
So, like, when you eat something sour, what makes, like, right here kind of, like...
Yeah, that cringing, or that feeling that you get is that your nervous system is causing the muscles, the smooth muscles lining the salivary glands. There are three sets of salivary glands, and two of them are right here. They're called the parotid sides. Parotid means by the ears. Otid means ear. And you can squeeze on them and get the same feeling. It'll make your mouth water. But that's what's happening. That tastant being delivered to your mouth tells your nervous system, get some saliva in there quickly. And so they really squeeze, and you can feel that. It's kind of a jolt. Okay. We can see a close-up view in slide 20 of taste buds. Taste buds also have hair-like sensory cells called gustatory hairs for exactly the same reason. Maximizes the surface area. And by the way, speaking of the saliva, it's important for several different reasons, but one reason that pertains to sensation is that if you put tastants into your mouth, food that contains tastants, it'll be much less likely that they will actually bind to a receptor if they're not first dissolved in liquid, which then flows over all of the taste buds. So that's one use of saliva, is it the watery component of saliva dissolves the tastants, giving them a much better chance of matching up with a chemoreceptor. Oh yeah, yeah, and there's examples of things that certain people can taste if they have the right version of the gene, and it's really bitter. It's called phenylthiocarbamide, or PTC. You had a little piece of paper. Some people will say it tastes like paper. There's no taste to it, and other people will it's really, really bitter. You either taste it or you don't at all, and that just depends on the genes. But yeah, other kinds of animals can taste things that we have no ability to taste. Oh, I keep forgetting that that's the last slide. So we are done now for the unit, and I won't start a new chapter because I want to wait until after we do the test. That means you have a half hour to do whatever you want for the lab.